Detroit, Michigan, October 14, 1962. Address by Paul Wilson.
Are waiting the archangel's heaven sent cry, which wakes the saints now sleeping and to thee brings them nigh. When we, with them ascending, shall meet thee in the air, to gaze upon thy glory and all thy likeness bear. Number 140. O Lord, our hearts are.
And to thee bring them.
I thought this afternoon is to read the 12th chapter of Hebrews. I'd like to make a comment or two concerning the epistle to the Hebrews. That the epistle to the Hebrews is the epistle of our wilderness journeys, our wilderness experience. I've known some brothers who seem to like to speak only of the epistle to the Ephesians, where we get our heavenly calling, that is, that our life is hid with Christ in God. We're seen in him up there. I was quoting from Colossians, however, but our life is seen up there. He's there. He's our life. And we're down here, seated in him up there before God. Precious truth in the epistle to the Ephesians. The highest note, I suppose, that we have in any of the epistles. But in the epistle to the Hebrews, we're in the wilderness and we find instruction for the wilderness journey. And we need it. I think if one Christian were to be occupied only with the epistle to the Ephesians, he would lack much for his wilderness journey, for his feet day by day. Now here we come to the 12th chapter. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin, or sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down on the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. Ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin, and ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children, My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? But if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure. But he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Now no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yieldeth a peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Wherefore lift up the hands which hang down, and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. lest there be any fornicator or profane person, as he saw, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. For ye know how that afterward, when he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears. For ye are not come unto the mount that might be touched, that burned with fire, nor unto blackness and darkness and tempest, and sound of a trumpet, and the voice of words which spake, which voice they that heard entreated that the word should not be spoken to them any more. For they could not endure that which was commanded. And if so much as a beast touch the mountain, it shall be stoned or thrust through with a dart. And so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I exceedingly fear and quake. But ye are come unto Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, the general assembly and church of the firstborn, which are written in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaketh better things than that of Abel. See that ye refuse not him that speaketh, for if they escape not, who refused him that spake on earth, how much more shall not we escape if we turn away from him that speaketh from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth, but now he hath promised, saying, yet once more I shake not the earth only, but also heaven. And this word yet once more signifieth the removing of those things that are shaken, as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. Wherefore we, receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. We've just read the 12th chapter of the Epistle to the Hebrews. The first expression, wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, takes us back to the previous chapter. Now, in the previous chapter, we have a long list of those who lived and died in faith. They didn't receive the promises. They had promises, but they didn't receive the fulfillment of them. They went on day by day looking forward to something that didn't come in their day. Now, if we would go back to the epistle to the Hebrews, to the 11th chapter of this epistle, we would find two characteristics of faith. The patience of faith and the energy of faith. Now, you and I may be called to exercise faith in our wilderness pathway, either in patience or in energy. One may be needed, and then the other, or both together. You go down the chapter and you find patience. Abraham went out not knowing whither he went. And then you go on and come down all the way to Moses when he came to years before you get the energy of faith. You get Moses refusing, Moses choosing, Moses making the right choice. Oh, I'm glad Moses made the right choice. Moses could cast off all of Egypt's honor, its pleasure, its wealth, just put it all aside, and cast in his lot with a company of slaves. Why? Because he saw that that company of slaves were God's people. It took faith to do that, to leave the throne, to leave the royal family and all its advantages, and go and cast your lot in with a company of slaves. You know, if we hadn't had Moses' life of faith, the energy of faith that carried him forward, he would never have been on the Transfiguration Mount with the Lord of glory. Now, you probably would be able to go to the British Museum today and find his mummy. He'd have probably made a pretty good mummy along with some of the other pharaohs to be put in the British Museum. But instead, he shared a place on the Transfiguration Mount with the Lord of glory in that preview of the coming kingdom. Well, you go down the whole 11th chapter, and it's faith in one way or another. May I make this comment, too, about the word faith? The first part of the first verse of the 11th chapter of Hebrews says, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. The better translation there is, faith is the conviction of things hoped for. No, the substantiating of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Faith enables you to lay hold of what you don't see. That's the meaning of it. Faith is the substantiating of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Some people speak of this first verse of the 11th of Hebrews as though it were a definition of faith. It isn't. It's what faith does. The better definition, or the best definition of faith than I know of, is he that hath received his testimony hath set to his seal that God is true. He says, I believe God, and I believe what God says. He accepts that. Abraham believed God. The Apostle Paul said, sirs, I believe God. That's faith. Every man has faith in something. They pick up the morning paper and they read about places and people they've never seen, and they accept it without question on the word of men. But they pick up the Bible and read, if they do, and they question it, but the real thing is they're questioning the word of God. Mr. Darby made this remark concerning Catholicism, which pretends to tell you what the word means. He says it's really infidelity. For instance, if I come into the room and I say I just saw an accident down the street and a man was killed, and you say, well, I have no reason to doubt your veracity or the worthiness of your report, but I'll wait till I hear it from somebody else before I accept it. Well, if somebody else comes along and tells you, and then you believe it, you're believing on their testimony and not mine. You reject my word as untrustworthy. So when God gives us his word and I say, I'll only believe it if the church confirms it. If the church explains it and gives it to me, then I'll believe it. I'm not believing it because God gave it. And in substance, it's infidelity. But now faith in the epistle to the Romans is that principle on which we are saved. Faith believes God, believes my lost condition. Faith believes God's remedy. I accept his salvation that meets my need. Faith is the principle on which we're saved in the epistle to the Romans. In the epistle to the Hebrews, faith is the principle upon which I live in this world. It's the living, practical reality of how I take God and His Word to direct my path day by day. Faith is the substantiating of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good report. You go down the chapter and there were many of them. They obtained a good report through faith. We come to the first verse of the 12th chapter, which we've already read. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, that means only that we've had this long list of those that lived and died in faith in the 11th chapter. They've been given to encourage us to go on in the path of faith. Here they are lined up. Some people have tried to explain it that they are in heaven watching us now. There's nothing to that. There's no truth in that. But here we have them in the 11th chapter as those that preceded us in the path of faith. Now they should be an encouragement to us to go on in their steps. That is, in the path of faith down here, day by day. Now let us lay aside, we're to go on in that path of faith that these Old Testament saints had. And remember, this was written to converted Hebrews. Converted Hebrews were constantly in danger of turning back to Judaism. And that was apostasy. It was to give up Christ and go back to shadows. Suppose you're waiting for a man to come, and you see his shadow coming down the street, and you're quite elated to see his shadow. You know he's coming. But after he comes, who wants to go out and look for a shadow? You have him. Well, in the New Testament, we have the substance of the things of which the Old Testament was the shadow. And for a converted Jew to give up the substance for a shadow was to give up Christ for ceremonies that preceded. Let us lay aside every weight. Hebrews 12, we just read the whole chapter. Speaking now of the first verse. Let us lay aside every weight and sin. I believe that these should be left out there. If you put it in, the sin referred to in Hebrews would be unbelief. Let us lay aside every weight and sin which does so easily beset us. Do you know there are things that easily beset us down there? Things that are hindrances to us in the path of faith. Now he said there are two things. One are weights. The other, sins. Sin. Let us lay aside. Notice how easily he puts it. It isn't as though it were some Herculean task, something that we had to really bend all effort to. He says, let us just lay it aside. As though it were easy. You just don't be encumbered with it. Just put it aside. Let us lay aside every weight. Well, you and I, each one of us, know what are weights to us. What would be a weight to one in pressing on in the path of faith would not be to another. It's often been said that if a man wanted to run a race and win the race, a bag of gold would be a weight. If he were bent on winning the race, he'd cast away the bag of gold because he couldn't win the race and carry the gold with him. So he'd just lay it aside and go on and win. Let us lay aside every weight. And the devil has plenty of weights, something to encumber us to slow us down in the race. You and I, fellow Christian, are in a race. We're not just saved to be passive. We're not just saved to get in the boat and rest on our oars and float downstream, for that's the only way you can float is down. No, we're to be actively engaged. Let us press on. There's a race. The Apostle Paul says in the Epistle to the Philippians, this one thing I do. And he says, down to the goal I press. He has the goal before him. Well, that's what we need. We're in a race. We're in an obstacle race. We have many obstacles, hindrances, things to impede our progress. I'm sure that any one of us that have reached any maturity in the Christian pathway can look back and say, well, in such and such years, I was impeded in my pilgrim pathway by allowance of this or allowance of that. Things that crowded in on us that hindered us from making advance in the race of the pilgrim pathway. So he says, let us lay aside every weight and sin. Well, may we say this, that what may be a weight today may become sin tomorrow. That is, I may become more heavily engrossed with it to the point that it becomes a sin. But whether it be weights or sins, anything that prevents me from pressing on to the goal, and that's Christ in glory, I should just put it aside. Well, you say it isn't as easy as that. With the Lord's help, I believe it is. With the Lord's help. If there's something in your life or in my life that is a hindrance to my progress, may we have grace to seek the help from the Lord to just lay it aside as an encumbrance, as a hindrance. And let us run. That takes energy, doesn't it? Let us run. Can you and I run? It's the energy of faith that takes one forward. Let us run. Now let me say something else. It isn't natural energy that we run with. Let us run with endurance. It's an endurance race. Oh, the devil has so many obstacles and difficulties and problems that he tried to hinder us in the path of faith. Say, oh, why press on? Why not give up? I talked to a brother one night. I picked him up to take him to meeting, and he says, I have such a terrible headache, I don't know if I can take anything in. I said, well, why didn't you stay home? The Lord doesn't expect you to go if your headache's that bad. Well, he says, I'll tell you why I didn't stay home. He says, if I gave in and stayed home tonight, next week it'd be easy to stay home when I didn't have a headache. He says, I just won't give in on it. Well, no, I'm not advocating that, because there are times, and the Lord knows it, when physical conditions hinder us. But there is such a thing as allowing things to come in that hinder us from running the race. If I get into the way of not coming to the Bible readings, not coming to the prayer meetings, I'm not making progress in the race. I have allowed something to come in. Well, you say, what else can I do? My job is so terrible, I can't get around to it. Well, I believe we should seek the Lord's help to make some adjustment of it in some way that we can make his things first. Let us run with endurance, not mere fleshly energy, but endurance that we get from the Lord himself to carry us through. Run with endurance the race that is set before us. Well, I've gone to cities where I had maps to tell me how to go. And I have read the maps most carefully and still miss the road. It's a whole lot easier to have somebody with you. It's a whole lot easier to follow someone. Now he says, I want to have your eye on one that's ahead of you. I want you to keep your eye on the one that's already been in the race, looking steadfastly on Jesus, it should read. Keeping your eyes steadfastly on Jesus. the beginner and completer of faith. Leave out the word our. It's in italics. It doesn't belong there. He's not the leader and completer of our faith, but he's the leader or the beginner and completer of faith itself, the whole path of faith. He began and ended it in perfection. Every other one, all those listed in the 11th of Hebrews. Now remember, only their faith is mentioned there, not their failures. In fact, I don't think the failures of the Old Testament saints are recorded in the New, but with one exception, and that is Elijah made intercession against Israel, and that is recorded in the New. It was of such serious consequence. He made intercession against Israel. We should never make intercession against our brethren, but for them. So, looking steadfastly on Jesus, the one who began and completed the whole path of faith without wavering, without a failure, take Abraham, the father of the faithful. He went down into Egypt when a famine came. Was that faith? No, that was a lapse in the path of faith. And all the time he was in Egypt, he lost his tent and his altar. And when he came out of Egypt, he brought an Egyptian maid that was to plague his house for years to come. Abraham, the father of the faithful. And when he was down there, he denied his wife even. When we once get on the wrong path, there's no telling how far we go. But you go right down the list. There isn't an Old Testament saint of whom you can't say there's failure somewhere. He was the only one that began and completed the path of faith without intermission, without interruption or failure. But keep your eye on him. He's in the way. He's been in the way before you. Not on those ones listed in the 11th chapter, but on Jesus, the one who did it perfectly. Who, for the joy that was set before him, endured. We're to endure. He endured. How did he endure? Why, he was looking forward to accomplishing the Father's will and going back to the Father's right hand. Who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down on the right hand of the throne of God. In other words, keep your eye on one that ran the race in perfection from start to finish, and has reached the goal, is already there. Now we have one before us in the race that has attained the goal. Now there are four times in the Epistle to the Hebrews that the Lord is spoken of as having been seated at the right hand of God, with little variations as to the expressions. In the first chapter, he seats himself there as one having accomplished redemption. Well, he seats himself at the right hand of God as God. Who but God could sit down at God's right hand? In the seventh chapter, I think it's the seventh, we won't take time to turn to it. He's our great high priest at the right hand of the majesty of in the heavens. He's there as our high priest representing us at the very summit of power. That's where our high priest is, at the right hand of the majesty on high. In the 10th chapter, he's seated on high as the one that has accomplished the work of redemption. The work is all over. He'll never take up the work of redemption or have to do with sin again. That's over. That's the 10th chapter. The priest, there was no seat for him in the tabernacle or in the temple. His work was never done. But our Lord is seated there with the work all done. Now the fourth time is right here, and he's seated at God's right hand as the one who has won the race. He's attained the goal. Brethren, we're not running an uncertain race. The one that was in the pathway before us is already there. There is but that one in the waste which his footsteps have marked as his own, and we follow in diligent haste to the place where he's put on his throne, put on his crown. Oh, we follow in diligent haste the pathway of that blessed man that has attained the goal. For consider him. I think Mr. Darby even says, well, consider well. Consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your mind. Do you have some problems? Do the men at your work make it hard for you because you're a Christian? Do the other pupils at school make it difficult for you? Reject you from their company and cast you out? Consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself. You've never had anything like he had. You couldn't have what he had. As to the way he was rejected and suffered the rejection of men all through his pathway. Remember in the 11th of Matthew, he lists Bethsaida, Chorazin, and Capernaum as the cities wherein most of his mighty works were done, and he mentions that they had rejected him. And he pronounces, woe unto thee, woe unto thee, woe unto thee. But in the midst of it all, he says, but I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent, and hast revealed them unto babes. Well, that's the one that's before us in the race. Consider him well, that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself. Lest ye be wearied and faint in your mind. One thing that the devil uses and uses with great effect on the saints of God is discouragement. You remember the children of Israel, when they were about to enter the land, they're just about the end of the journey, and the people were much discouraged because of the way. Just at the end of their wilderness journey, they became discouraged. And then you remember what happened? Why, the serpents bit them. It all stemmed from discouragement. And the devil likes to discourage the saints of God. And remember, we're just at the end of the journey. And the devil would like to discourage you and me today. Get you to let your hands hang down. Say, oh, what's the use? Now, I know we're in the last days, and there is such a way of speaking of the last days as to discourage people and say, well, what's the use? Why try any longer? Just let's go like a dead fish and go with the current. Brethren, let's press on. It's at the end of the journey that he tries to discourage the saints. It was at the end of the wilderness journey that he discouraged Israel. He couldn't keep them from getting into the land, but he could spoil their abundant entrance. He could hinder their enjoyment of getting into that land by having discouraged them at the end of the way. Now he says in the fourth verse, ye have not yet resisted unto blood striving against sin. That one that was in the way before us did. Someone has said he would rather die than not do the will of the Father. I often think, too, of that awful night in the Garden of Gethsemane. There Satan was pressing upon him what it would be to be made sin, what awaited him the next day, and he finally takes it all from the Father's hand, and he says, not my will, but thine be done. He has the victory and he comes out perfectly calm, and goes forth to meet the betrayer and the mob, and goes forth knowing that he's going right to the cross to accomplish that work, the will of the Father. And what happened in that garden? He prayed earnestly, and being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly. And his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood falling to the ground. The agony was so intense at night that the sweat fell down to the ground. But more than that, it was tinged with blood. Can you imagine such extreme agony that blood would exude through the pores? I've heard of people doing it, having that happen to them, in a terribly weakened condition, that their blood would be exuded through the pores. Oh, but the agony that Christ endured in the Garden of Gethsemane, anticipating what it would be to be made sin. He says, "You have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin." Sometimes there is very little real courage, real endurance with us in standing out for God in an evil world. "And ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him." Here are two ways that we can treat God's dispensations with us in child training. Chastening is really child training. Two ways we can treat it that are both wrong: faint or despise. Now, how can we faint? Well, we just get so discouraged when difficulties come, things that God allows for our training and for our profit, we get discouraged and we let the hands hang down. How about despising it? Well, a man says, "Well, I'll do it, I'll carry it through." It's nothing but human fortitude. I've seen saints of God meet the most adverse circumstances, perhaps difficult cases where God was allowing it to exercise it, and they met it in human fortitude. Now, that's despising the chastening of the Lord, if I can just rise above it and throw it off and not seek to find out what the Lord would teach me in it. So he says, "Ye have forgotten the exhortation. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him, for whom the Lord loveth he chasteneth." Do we ever consider, when difficulties and trials come across our pathway, that it's because of his love? They're all evidences of his love. He says, "Why, if God doesn't treat you that way, you're not a son at all." He says, "You've forgotten the exhortation," says this. And then he says, if you endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? Would you want to go through this world without any correction? Some of us have seen children that were brought up without any correction. What sorry children they turned out to be. No correction, just do their own will. Well, if you plant a tree in your yard, and the tree's leaning one way, you can let that tree alone and let it lean, and it'll lean farther and farther. It's over a little more and a little more. And after a while, you can't even begin to straighten it. It's so old and so set, you couldn't straighten it. If it's going to be straightened, it's going to have to be straightened while it's young and tender. And so our God deals with us. Would we want to not have him do it? Would we dare say to God, "I'd rather be let alone. I'd rather not be corrected. I'd rather not be trained." Oh, I hope not. We need these things. Furthermore, ninth verse, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? We recognize the authority of our fathers on earth. Shall we not much rather be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they verily after... Now, let's correct this rendering here. For they verily corrected us as seemed best to them. Not for their pleasure, but as seemed best to them. They may not have been wise. They may have failed in their methods. They may have been failed in lack of a firmness. They may have failed in being too severe. But he doesn't make those mistakes. We submitted to our fathers in the flesh who corrected us as seemed best to them. There may have been mistakes in what they did. But he, for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. What is God working out with us down here? Why, he's seeking to, in all these things, bring us to holiness. He's correcting this thing and the other thing. Oh, he does it with a wise hand. Our Father is all wise. Our parents were not always wise. He's all loving. And he's all powerful. Well, our parents weren't all powerful. They weren't always all wise. But we gave them reverence. But our Father is all loving, all wise, all powerful. Now, in his love, he wants to do what's the very best for us. In his wisdom, he knows what is very best for us. And in his power, he's able to do what is very best for us. So we can't fail to get the blessing. And the end might be partakers of his holiness. Oh, God, we're in the school down here. There's one thing about it. If you go to school down here in the world, you go to this college or this school or the other, you'll get a degree when you finish it, or you'll get a diploma or something. But you know, in the school of God, in which every one of us are, we'll never get a diploma down here. Never get a diploma down here. No, we await the judgment seat of Christ for his appraisal of it all. We're not looking for diplomas here, but he's training us. He's dealing with us that we might be partakers of his holiness. Now, no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. I heard today a letter from California of different ones that are suffering severe trials. There's a dear sister there, known to some of you here, Selma Kutcher, in Los Angeles. She's pitifully crippled with arthritis. She was having so much pain in one limb from varicose veins. They put her in the hospital and got a specialist to take care of the situation. Today I learned that the specialist, in examining the limb, heard some grating of bones. He rushed her in to call a bone specialist and rushed her in for an x-ray and found the leg was broken in two places. Hard. No chastening for the present seemed to be joyous, but grievous. But nevertheless, after. There's an afterward to all of it. It may be an afterward when we be with Christ. Afterward it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them who are exercised thereby. Now that's the third way to treat that we can treat God's dispensations. First, despise or neglect or be exercised by it. Be exercised. That's the way we should treat them. Oh, I don't mean that we should be morose and get down with everything that comes along. I have known Christians that were just so long-faced, they were always down under something and wonder what God was doing this or that for. I think we should hold a simple, childlike attitude, desiring that we may know the Lord's will in these things. And if something crosses our path, we can go to him and seek to know why, or what he would teach us. Maybe it's not for correction at all. Maybe it's preventive. You know, Mr. Brown tells us that there are three words that express God's dealings with us as children, and he uses three P's to do it. Preventive, preparatory, and punitive. He tells me it isn't original with him, but I got it from him. Preparatory, well, maybe God brings us through a lot of hard circumstances that we may comfort others with the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. Now, that's one of the characteristics of preparatory discipline. Maybe it's a case where God was going to use one in where he would have to endure hardship and privations. Well, maybe he trains them beforehand in allowing privations and hardships as they grow up so that they're accustomed to it, that he may train them for what's coming. Preparatory. Or it may be preventive. You can imagine a young man in high school. He's all taken up with sports. He's on the football team, and he's on this, and he's on that. Everything that shows natural energy. Well, suppose the Lord sees that he's going the wrong direction and is going to carry him into the world. Maybe he allows him to break his leg and get put out of it. He may always live to thank God for it while he's here. We have a brother in California that as a young boy fell out of a tree, broke his back. He'll always go on crutches, always have to go on crutches. But one time his mother was weeping about his condition and his hardships and suffering. He says, "Mother, if you see me getting away from the Lord, weep. But don't weep for this." Oh, he learned something. And he realized that the Lord had allowed it in his dispensations for his good. Lots of things trouble us that are not pleasant. Now he says, 12th verse, "Wherefore lift up the hands that hang down and the feeble knees." I remember what A.H. Rule once wrote on this point. I enjoyed it. He says, in this chapter we find that we have to run. We have to run with endurance. But he says, when we come down this far in the chapter, we find that we don't run singly. We run as a group. We run as a flock. We're not just to run on our own independently of all the rest. We have to run together. And so he says, "Wherefore lift up the hands that hang down and the feeble knees." There are some saints that we're going to have to carry as long as they're here or we're here. We're going to have to bear with them and help them and carry them. They're weak. And God allows the flock to have weak ones in it. If we had our way, we would have a perfect flock. Now, ravenism tries to accomplish having a perfect flock. And so they cast out everybody that doesn't come up to a certain standard. They've cast out hundreds and hundreds in the last year or two. Follow this rule and follow it exactly, or out you go. But the Lord allows some weak ones to be with us, and it wouldn't be right if we didn't have some respect for weakness. I'm not saying that there are not cases of sin that need to be judged, but I'm speaking now of what the Lord speaks of. "Wherefore lift up the hands that hang down." Is there a brother discouraged? Can you encourage him? Do we not have a responsibility toward him? And the feeble knees. I think Mr. Garby renders that faint-hearted, I'm not sure. But it gives a better idea of it. Not only hands inclined and let down, but the knees are weak, we're faint-hearted, we're ready to give up. you and I have a responsibility to the weak brother. We're not running single file. We're not soloing. We're not just going alone. And make straight paths for your feet. Mr. Darby says that a good man can run over any kind of a course. He can get over obstacles that a lame man would fall over. God allows us to have some of the lame with us too. Make straight paths for your feet, lest the lame be turned out of the way. Yes, we have to look out for the lame. I knew a place one time where some trouble came into the meeting and a lot of the lame were turned out of the way. Then I got a letter from one party there and said, well, so-and-so, brother and sister, have just come into the meeting and they show real interest, and they were here when they were coming to the meetings when all the trouble was on, and now they've asked for their place. And that just goes to prove that only those that wanted to were discouraged or turned aside. I don't believe that. I don't believe that. It doesn't prove that only those that wanted to be turned out of the way were turned out of the way. There are the lame. And I know that there were some of the lame that were turned out of the way. Make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way. Oh, what crooked paths we make. I remember one time I was driving through Oregon with a brother. Late year, and it was up near the Crater Lake area. And it was night, and the snow was coming down very heavy. The heavy fall of snow is beautiful, right between a lot of tall pines. It got heavier and heavier. Finally, this brother said, look, there's a track to weather. That man just went by us. He says, look at what a crooked path he made. He says, I suppose he's looking at our crooked path right now. It wasn't straight. Which of us can boast that our path has been so straight that others could really follow a straight path? But nevertheless, there is a responsibility to make straight paths for your feet. Let it rather be healed, the lame. Follow peace with all and holiness. Oh, again, there's holiness mentioned. We need holiness. God requires it, without which no man shall see the Lord. Suppose a man would come to you and say, do you believe in holiness? What would you say? Wouldn't you say, I certainly do? Not this spurious kind of holiness that people talk about, that they think that they have acquired a certain status and elevated themselves by their own bootstraps to the place where they never sin anymore. That isn't it. But God has called us, the God who has called us is holy. And he says, so be ye holy. Holiness becomes our God and becomes his house forever. Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Looking diligently. Doesn't say just looking. It says looking diligently, lest any man lack the grace of God. It's not just fail of the grace of God, lest any man lack the grace of God. Lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and many be defiled. I have seen some of the smallest little roots work and work until the whole meeting, the whole assembly was in confusion. Looking diligently, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. You know some root of bitterness that's springing up? Well, let's choke it off. Let's do something about it. Most of these roots of bitterness are just ideas. They're clashes of personalities. Looking diligently, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. I've seen cases that were nothing in the world but a clash of personalities. Brethren, this is a practical chapter. This is a wilderness chapter. This is a way to walk down here to please God and what He's working out in us down here and how we run together and we have a responsibility toward one another. I don't think there's anything farther from the truth than to hear somebody say, what I do is my own business. No, I know we often meddle with the other man's business, the other brother's business, when we shouldn't. But what I do does affect others, and we can't avoid it. Looking diligently, lest any man lack the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. I don't suppose we better go farther with faster time, but I would comment one thing just for correction's sake. Many have thought in that 17th verse that Esau repented and couldn't find any place for repentance. But that's a wrong thought. It's a wrong interpretation of the verse. He sought the blessing, and he couldn't get it. There was no place for that. He had rejected what God had given. He had spurned his title, his birthright, which amounted to a title to the land of Canaan. He'd spurned God's gift, and then he wanted to come back and get a blessing, and he couldn't get it. There was no place for it. He was rejected, though he sought the blessing carefully with tears, not a place for repentance. Well, I think we should stop there. We sing that verse in 139, maybe a stanza or two in it. Third and fourth. Might sing 3, 4, 5, and 6. There is but that one in the waste which his footsteps have marked as his own, and we follow in diligent haste to the seats where he's put on his crown. For the path where our Savior is gone has led up to his Father and God, to the place where he's now on the throne, and his strength shall be ours on the road. Stanzas 3, 4, 5, and 6, 139.